Brand new single from Joe Normal and the Anytowners. Just literally got it in the mail within the last few days. Stuck in a Job from Joe Normal and the Anytowners. Before that, Robin Hitchcock went back to 1989 for Madonna of the Wasps. Played some Spy Genius in there from their Man on the Sea album. Heard the song Another True Story. Also some brand new music from a project called Anything After. The song was Medicine. A buddy of mine said, hey, I know this dude and he's got this project and check it out. Didn't ask me to play it on my radio show. He just said, check it out. And I was like, will your buddy mind if I play it on my radio show? Why not? So I did. Young Fresh Fellows start off that entire set. Yeah, that was the theme to Sesame Street. Again, celebrating the work of Joe Raposo, who passed away on this day back in 1989 at the age of 51. Sad, sad. Hey, we got about 3.5 minutes before we get to the top of the hour, which gives me lots of time to just ramble and talk to you and tell you stuff. You know, remind you that the American Red Cross wants you and your family to be prepared for an emergency. Download any of their free mobile apps to have critical information on what to do in an emergency right there in the palm of your hand. Their apps include first aid, hurricane, earthquake, tornado, and wildfire information. Find the American Red Cross. Find these apps by searching Red Cross in the Apple iTunes or Google Play stores, wherever you get your favorite apps. And I forgot to remind you, I normally tell you this a little earlier, but you've hung on long enough for me to just talk about food, because Spack Brothers Pizza joined June supporting WRCT Pittsburgh. Spack Brothers, they offer pizza, they offer hoagies, they offer wings, yeah! They also specialize in vegan and vegetarian alternatives. Spack Brothers Pizza, they use no refined sugars in their sauce, they don't have any unbleached flour in their dough. Spack Brothers Pizza is located at 5107 Penn Avenue in the Garfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. For more information, 412-362-SPAK, online at spackbrothers.com. That's 412-362-7725 or spakbrothers.com. Let me remind you, I've got a mock coming up in just over an hour. We're doing a Barrett Strong mock at midnight. Songs he either performed and or wrote for others will be the theme of the mock. We've got a radio and a music calendar coming up as well. And don't forget, I do take requests. They're just delayed. Just delayed. There's a little delay on those requests. About a week or so. Usually about a week. Got to send me an email to wrcrequest@gmail.com. My name is Paul. This is a show called Diva LaMock. Comes to you every Friday night from 9 p.m. until 1 a.m. If you are listening and it is not a Friday night and you're hearing my voice and I'm telling you it's Friday night and you're like, no, Mockster guy. It's Tuesday afternoon. It's Wednesday evening. It's 3 in the morning. Well, that means you're listening to an encore presentation of the Viva LaMock radio program. That's all. Nothing more. Just an encore presentation because it was so good it could not withstand just one four-hour block on this radio station. I got a music and a radio calendar coming up. Let's get some business. Let's take care of some business before we get to that.
You've tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs anthology from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, pandemonium.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon from WRCT, and I'm joined here on a park bench on a beautiful summer day by Carnegie Mellon University professor Brian Junker. Brian, what department are you in?
Hi, Richard. It's good to be here. I'm in the Department of Statistics and Data Science.
Okay. I'm so old that when I went to college, there was no computer science major. There was applied math. How long has statistics always had its own departments?
No, statistics used to be a part of the math department, and that's generally historically how statistics departments get started. Eventually, the mathematicians and the statisticians realize they can't talk to each other very well, and so statistics breaks off and forms its own department. That happened in the late 60s or the 70s at Carnegie Mellon.
Okay, well, we're not here to talk about office politics. We're here to talk about lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Oh, man, you really like to offend statisticians when you interview them, don't you?
Well, you know, ever since I was a kid, you know, like reading Mad Magazine and stuff, I kind of remember there was one joke book about chocolate. And one of the points was, how much protein was in chocolate? And here was this stat about this enormous amount of protein. But then there was an asterisk noting the gargantuan amount of chocolate you'd have to eat. I think that's everybody's sort of the layperson's appreciation of statistics. It's like people tell their own stories, making things up with the numbers.
Right. Absolutely true. And in fact, for the last, 30, 40 years, there's been a strong movement toward increasing numeracy for the layperson, just like literacy was a big issue that led to the formation of public schools and things like that. But I will say that, you know, once you become a little bit numerate, that is, once you sort of become a little bit less afraid of the numbers and can interpret them, what you realize is that all those lies and damn lies are equally tellable with numbers as with language. Open the newspaper. Look at what's in the newspaper that's written in English. Listen to, your favorite news channel that you hate. And listen to what they have to say. With no numbers at all, they're equally capable of lying. So it's just learning another language, like learning French or German or Chinese.
People can do so many different things with the numbers. Like one of the quotes you had up on your website from C.H. Combs was, we buy information with assumptions. And those assumptions show up in the numbers that we hear in the news.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I actually specifically went and refound that quote myself because I wanted to make sure to bring it up during our talk today. It's one of my favorite aphorisms. It really is. Assumptions are really important. I mean, what you can collect from the real world, what you collect is facts. You collect data without any context or interpretation. And the way you convert that data into information, first of all, is by organizing it. And organizing it requires assumptions. You have to sort of know what you're looking for when you're organizing the data. And then to actually use that information in some useful way, you typically are trying to make a prediction about the future. And the only way to do that is to make assumptions about how the data was generated and how it'll happen in the future. So, yeah, you have to have raw information, you have to have assumptions, you combine them, and that's how you get knowledge and prediction. And if you have the wrong assumptions, or assumptions that don't fit very well, you make terrible inferences and terrible predictions about what's going to happen in the future.
That's one of the things that, as a statistician, you help your students understand?
Absolutely. I think my specialty and the specialty of a lot of statisticians is building statistical models, which are really mathematical formulations of the assumptions that you need to understand how the data arose or how to make predictions from the data. And that's what we teach. That's a part of what we teach in the Department of Statistics and Data Science. is how to build those models and how to use those models, how to use those assumptions. Whether you're trying to select the best football player to recruit for the Steelers, or you're trying to predict the efficacy of COVID vaccines or whatever, it's all a combination of facts and models.
Or people my age, if you're trying to make your retirement savings last.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that also is a matter of prediction. You're making assumptions about what's going to happen in the economy. Should I take my investments out of high yield, high risk products and put them in something safe, or will I go with the assumption that the economy is going to grow for a while first?
We're talking with Brian Junker from the Carnegie Mellon Department of Statistics and Data Science. And one of the things that has led me to come talk to you, Brian, is just seeing how much numbers are part of the story that Republicans and Democrats and different countries, and it's all part of the story that they're trying to sell to the consumer, to the reader of the news, the watcher of the TV.
Well, absolutely. And I think, historically, and here's a little etymology lesson, if you will. The word statistics is derived from the word state. And really, statistics began as a way of organizing data so that governments could better govern, at least better in the view of the people who were governing. So some of the earliest statistics had to do with understanding how much farmland there was, or how much crops were grown, so that governments would know how much to tax. That has grown so that now we use statistics in the form of summarized data to understand how welfare should be distributed, how Congress people should be distributed across the states, and so forth. So that kind of information, again, whether it's used with good intention or with bad, is a central part of government.
Using information for good or bad, you're making it sound like it's a double-edged sword that anybody can use for any purpose.
Well, that's pretty much true. I mean, tools are tools, and the goodness or the badness of tools depends on how you use them. You can use a hammer to build a house, or you can use a hammer to hurt someone. It's a hammer either way, and you try to use the hammer for good instead of for bad.
How do educational institutions like Carnegie Mellon, how do they use statistics?
You mean the institution itself?
Yes.
So there is an Office of Institutional Research at Carnegie Mellon. It has a slightly fancier name than that, but that's basically the idea.
As at many universities. Yeah.
Most universities have that, and they are collecting data about students and about departments and about the functioning of the university. Sometimes directly by looking at records that the university is keeping anyway, and sometimes by doing surveys to find out what students are happy with or what they're worried about. Those kinds of surveys happen essentially every year. There's a survey that's given to all incoming freshmen, and then another survey that happens, I believe, at the end of the first year, and then mostly at the department level, there are exit surveys for students who are graduating.
What kind of data are they looking for?
Well, with those surveys, they're looking mostly for example, what students may know or think they know when they come to Carnegie Mellon as freshmen. And then the later surveys often are addressed to questions about what the students have learned while they're at Carnegie Mellon. There may also be questions about, things that are not so much knowledge related, but are related to the kinds of experiences students have had, whether they feel comfortable at the university, whether they feel like they can go to professors to talk about things, or other students to talk about things. All those kinds of things affect not only the knowledge that's imparted at Carnegie Mellon, but also the atmosphere of Carnegie Mellon. And like most universities, Carnegie Mellon is interested in optimizing both of those things.
Institutional research and data collection. Obviously, governments do a lot of that, and then it gets repeated in the news media. You see people freaking out about COVID-19 vaccines because of this or that factual tidbit that comes out. How does taking a measured statistical approach help someone understand what's going on in a situation like dealing with whether or not to be vaccinated or those kinds of things?
Well, I think to some extent this is another area in which that idea of numeracy becomes really important. And it's not so much being familiar with numbers, because after all, we all know about the 10 digits and we know how they combine to form other numbers. But it's really understanding something about how experiments are designed and conducted to understand how effective a vaccine is, or to understand what the side effects of a vaccine might be. And I think with something like the COVID vaccine, what's important to understand is, among other things, is that although the process was accelerated relative to other vaccines, these vaccines that have been so effective, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine and several others, are built on more than a decade of research. And they went through the same rigorous process of experimental evaluation that every other vaccine that is approved by the U.S. government goes through. And understanding that process, even a little bit, is really helpful in deciding whether you're going to do the vaccine yourself.
You used again that term numeracy, which I think of in terms of understanding how the numbers are used. And one of the things that I know some people are freaking out, I'll say, oh, this vaccine is only listed at 75% effective or 92% effective, but they don't go back and look to see what that means. That means even if someone gets a mild case, it counts as a strike against the vaccine. But in general, if you look overall, it's been reducing the virulence of the outbreak. But people just hear that number, and it's not 100.
Right. Well, there are no 100s in the world. And that's the other thing, that statistics is really helpful in helping people understand, is that very, very few things in this world are completely certain. And one of the things that statisticians do is develop methods for deciding how certain or uncertain a result or a fact is. The good thing about the vaccines for COVID, for example, is that by and large, they're really highly effective. A number like 92% is an amazing number for a vaccine, especially when what we're considering is the failures, as you say, the breakthrough infections are likely to be greatly ameliorated by the vaccine, by the antibodies that your body builds up because of the vaccine.
We're talking with Brian Junker from Carnegie Mellon's Department of Statistics and Data Science. And as you're talking about this and how people can manipulate numbers a little bit to sort of tell their own story, I think of economics and all the economic models that get built, but they're all built on assumptions.
They certainly are. I mean, I think the thing that economics adds to statistics is thinking more carefully, or at least making thoughtful assumptions about what the value of different outcomes is. And so, we might be thinking about something like opening up an institution for public use that's been closed for over a year because of COVID. And when you open that institution, there are several possibilities. There's several possible outcomes. One possible outcome is that everything is fine and there are no infections and certainly no serious infections. And another outcome is that there are some level of infections, or maybe even one or two serious infections. And each of those carries a benefit or a cost. And thinking about the kinds of trade-offs that one's willing to make in terms of costs and benefits is extremely important. And one does it explicitly every time one walks down the sidewalk or gets in a car and drives somewhere. There are risks involved in driving a car. But implicitly, we calculate the cost-benefit trade-off, and typically we get in the car and drive because the benefits are better than the costs. And the same sort of thing has to happen with a vaccine or with reopening of an institution or anything like that.
What about governments? I'm enough older than you, Brian, that I can remember, quote, tornado drills. They were really air raid drills. And, you know, sort of living in that, in the height of the Cold War and Khrushchev putting missiles in Cuba. So through my youth, it was mostly you call someone a commie and that's all you had to do. And now it sort of seems like things are so much more sophisticated that as people fight about political things, they're calling up all sorts of numbers to support their point of view.
Well, that's probably true, although I certainly see a lot of name-calling in the public square now, too, and the name-calling is much more effective than I'd like it to be. The nice part about numbers is that as long as the numbers come with sources, it's possible to verify and decide for yourself whether those numbers actually tell the story that the speaker is trying to tell.
But we've got arguments about whether or not elections were stolen and whether or not the data needs to be audited.
Election data typically is audited automatically as a matter of law or policy by whatever governmental unit is responsible, whatever local jurisdiction is responsible for the election. And I think that what we are seeing with the political calls for additional audits is not so much an interest in establishing facts, but an interest in raising enough dust that it's difficult to find the facts. And of course, that's anathema to anyone who has a scientific bent or a statistical bent, because after all, we want to know what the actual data is. And our best source for the actual data is the election data that was recorded by the local jurisdiction and audited by the normal procedures that the law and policy allows for.
In a lot of states, the county does its own audit, and sometimes the state secretary of state will do a follow-up.
Absolutely right. And those public servants, although often they're, in fact, almost all the time, they're members of a political party, they understand their job to be essentially neutral with respect to party. And that's one thing that's missing in the additional audits that are being called for political reasons. Another thing that's missing is the care with which one would normally do an audit and the reliance on standardized procedures for doing an audit. Just like with an experiment, if you don't do the experiment according to standardized procedures, you can't trust the outcome. And that's true for many of the politically motivated audits as well.
Numeracy, getting people to understand what the numbers really mean. What? Oh my God, we've seen 100% increase in this or that, and we're going from 2 to 4 versus, oh my God, we've seen 100% increase in this. We've gone from 20,000 to 40,000. What are the kinds of things you think are really important for the American public, students at Carnegie Mellon, anyone listening to the radio, that they need to really be aware of to put numbers that they hear, statistics that they hear, in perspective?
So I think even your example, 2 to 4 versus 20,000 to 40,000, raises an issue which I think is really important to think about whenever we're looking at data or claims about data, and that is, what is the practical significance of the claim? How can I figure out what the practical significance of the claim is? If I can take away whatever emotional content surrounds the claim, in both cases there's a 100% increase, and it may be that one of those claims is made with a great deal of emotion and the other is not. But what one wants to do is strip away the emotion as much as possible and think about the numbers underlying the factor of 2 increase and think, are those numbers practically important? Is an increase from 2 to 4 as important as an increase from 20,000 to 40,000? Well, it depends. You know, it depends on the context of the numbers. It depends on the assumptions that you're going to make about the numbers. These are the things that are really important about numeracy. Everyone knows what numbers are, but figuring out the context and figuring out the assumptions, those are the important parts.
Yeah, but sometimes people don't tell you all that. They just want to say there's been a 100% increase in X, Y, or Z. You know, it's done to fuel political rhetoric, not to increase knowledge.
Sure, absolutely. That's why it's so important to remain intellectually curious, to be curious enough to go try to find something out about the numbers if those numbers appear to be affecting you in some way. It's important to, I don't know, have a little bit of the lawyer in you, to have a little bit of the, you know, let's test this and see if this really is going to work.
We're talking with Brian Junker from Carnegie Mellon's Department of Statistics and Data Sciences. And since this conversation is going to air on a college radio station, here's something that I can remember was a big deal back from my days of working and teaching at the University of Delaware. So, Professor Junker, how much should students trust online faculty evaluations?
Oh my gosh. Do you have 3 hours, 4 hours, something like that? Online or offline, any kinds of evaluations of faculty by students are essentially just like the reviews you see on TripAdvisor or Yelp or anything else. They can be useful. It's not that they're entirely useless. But again, you need to understand the context in which the evaluations are given. And so as a student, you need to be looking for things that will be important to you about that class or that professor. Sometimes you're interested in an easy A. And so if the evaluations say, this guy gives a duck class, that's great news. And sometimes what you're interested in is really understanding a subject. And so you might be more interested in evaluation that says, well, you know, this guy was really hard, but at the end I understood. And so you can't look at those evaluations in a kind of a one-dimensional way. The numbers that come out at the end, they may or may not be useful to you, but the text that gives you the context, that seems to be a theme, context here, but the text that gives you a context, that's what's going to be important to students.
I can remember that when I was teaching at off-campus professor evaluation sites, you tended to see people either had an axe to grind or who just thought this was like the best thing since sliced deviled eggs.
Sure, and actually for that reason, it's a bit dangerous to aggregate student evaluations of faculty because, again, you're aggregating over a group where you don't have much control over who's in the group and who's out of the group. And so you may not be able to trust the aggregation very well. On the other hand, if you look through those reviews and you see something that speaks to you about that class or that professor.
In the actual written comments.
In the actual written comments. If you look at the anecdotes instead of the averages, sounds strange for a statistician to say, but but that's the case. You really want to look at the anecdotes and not the averages there because the averages are over groups that you just have no control over.
Brian Junker, I know you primarily as a banjo player. How has statistics informed your musical life?
Well,
or is it vice versa?
Oh, the answer is yes. Both ways, my goodness. So I have to say that kind of rigorous, curious, testing assumptions kind of thinking that goes into numeracy and actually comes from some past training I've had in mathematics, the pattern recognition parts, all of those things have influenced the way I approach music and the way I think about music. I will also say, in the reverse, playing music, playing banjo and guitar, little mandolin here and there, that has affected how I teach and how I think about teaching and actually how I think about talking with colleagues, talking with folks like you, talking with professional scientists that I might be consulting with. That idea of performance has really affected, in ways that I think are positive, the way I interact with students and the way I interact with colleagues and consultees and things like that.
Very interesting answer. I know that some people will talk about the mathematics in Bach, but you know, you're talking about the other side too, having it come back and influence your professional life.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's one of the really great things about being open to whatever experiences you have, is that experience in one area may well influence and inform and improve experience in another area. I have to say that's one of the things that attracted me to statistics initially anyway. One of the metaphors of statistics is that it's the crossroads of science, in the sense that that statisticians develop methods and develop models, these mathematical lists of assumptions, maybe to solve a problem in one area, like educational testing. And it turns out that those same models, those same assumptions, those same methods turn out to be useful in a completely different area, like counting the number of people in a population or assessing the success of an online tutoring system or something like that. And so the methods that you use in one area, you bring into the crossroads, you go out another road to another part of science or policy and discover that those same methods are useful somewhere else. You have to be open to different experiences.
As you were talking there, you mentioned counting people. And I know my son worked as a census taker one summer. I think it's pretty remarkable that we still try to do a nationwide census. But then, of course, there are all sorts of questions about its accuracy.
Well, that's true. We do a nationwide census because it's required as a part of our Constitution. So every 10 years, we have to do, and we should do, headcount of the population, essentially, and that feeds into things like the apportionment of representatives in the House of Representatives, and feeds into lots of our other government policies. Accuracy is a really difficult question for the census. There are groups that are reliably undercounted, such as those who are homeless whose addresses are not well established. And there are groups who are reliably overcounted, such as those who have multiple homes and may be moving between homes, their summer home and their winter home, during the census taking. And so accounting for those inaccuracies is an important part of census taking. And actually, it's a part of census work that has been the object of a great deal of political struggle. And one of the reasons for that is that undercounting in particular tends to happen among the part of the population that would be inclined to vote Democratic anyway. And overcounting tends to happen, conversely, in the part of the population that would be inclined to vote Republican. And so there are political reasons for preferring that either you do or don't account for those inaccuracies. And that's been an ongoing debate and an ongoing legal struggle in this country for quite a long time.
I believe X, you believe Y. I say my numbers support me. You say your numbers support you. What's a consumer of the media supposed to do?
Well, you got to get behind the numbers. You got to get to the actual facts. The numbers typically are a summary of what the actual facts are. And so either by digging into the sources that produce the numbers or by collecting facts yourself, you got to get behind the numbers. You have to understand where they come from in order to understand what seems trustworthy.
Brian Junker from the Department of Statistics and Data Science here at Carnegie Mellon. That was a great way to end this conversation. Thank you, Brian.
Hey, I've enjoyed it a lot. I didn't bring a banjo, but I know you brought a couple guitars, so maybe after this we can have some fun.
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a judge has approved a debt restructuring deal for Puerto Rico, and the deal's architects are saying it means a new day for the territory. Natalia Renta is senior policy strategist at the Center for Popular Democracy. We'll hear from her about what those outside of the deal-making, but nevertheless impacted by it, have to say. That's coming up, but first, a very quick look at some recent press. It's remarkable, elite media's eagerness, amid all the crying problems and difficulties we're facing, to beat the drums for a hot war with Russia. It's remarkable how little need is felt to go beyond an age-old playbook, which includes, first, an effort to get out in front and assert that the enemy is lying, even if it's true. In January 25th, Russia steps up propaganda war amid tensions with Ukraine. The New York Times asserts that, quote, Moscow and its online army of allies have pushed out old arguments about Western Ukrainians being aligned with Nazism, close quote. Note the paper avoids saying these are false arguments. They aren't, as Greg Shupak has recently explained for Fair.org. But in a story on propaganda, that's what you're supposed to think. The Times introduced a bizarre new thought crime, citing a researcher who said that, quote, Russian disinformation tactics in Ukraine used both falsified stories and those that were true but tangential to current events in order to distort narratives or hide true intentions, close quote. So a fact can be accurate, but if it's deemed tangential, not clear by whom, then that, too, is disinformation. The corollary to the unimaginably evil enemy is not looking behind the curtain of the U.S. position, beginning, so fundamentally that it's off the page, with the U.S. right to intervene anywhere, anytime, and anyhow to create geopolitical situations it deems to its advantage, which means the advantage of corporate investors and financiers, since it's hardly the little guy champing at this bit. With Ukraine, as Bryce Green writes for Fair.org, this entails the erasure of, for instance, the U.S. role in overthrowing Ukraine's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, who had rejected IMF so-called reforms and reintroduced talks with Russia. The U.S. fueled anti-government sentiment through entities like USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy, and weren't deflected by the opposition's inclusion of far-right and openly Nazi elements like the Right Sector. After the violent coup, these groups were incorporated into the Ukrainian armed forces, the same armed forces that the U.S. has now given $2.5 billion. U.S. journalists will wax poetic on war as a tragedy. They'll bemoan the loss of life and the lingering harms. But that's after. When it comes to Ukraine and Russia, we have a right to demand media openly consider these things before the bloodshed begins, and minimally that they stop uncritically beating the drums. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Puerto Rico received approval from a federal judge on Tuesday to leave bankruptcy under the largest public sector debt restructuring deal in the history of the United States. That's how a January 18th New York Times report begins. It's been nearly 5 years, the paper explains, since the, quote, financially strapped territory declared it could not repay its creditors, close quote. The executive director of the unelected Fiscal Oversight and Management Board declared it truly a momentous day and a new day for Puerto Rico. How new exactly is the question of many, who don't see this debt deal as fundamentally changing the story for most Puerto Ricans, because that story has everything to do with the more than 100-year colonial relationship to the United States and their enforced inability to determine their own economic future. Nor does it upend the notion that increased austerity is somehow, despite what you see, ultimately the way to a shared prosperity and well-being. Those with a different vision include our guest. Natalia Renta is senior policy strategist at the Center for Popular Democracy. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Natalia Renta.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the reception to this restructuring plan has to do with our understanding of debt. The picture we get from stories like this one in the Times and many others is Puerto Rico racked up a tremendous debt, and they're now being gifted with forgiveness of most of it. That sounds like beneficence, even beyond what's maybe appropriate to ask for. That's because for most people, debt means you took something and enjoyed it, and now you have to pay. Them's the rules. But history shows us that some debts are odious, are unfair from the start. So maybe I'd like to ask you to start with the nature of the debt that we're talking about here. Why, in simple terms, is Puerto Rico facing so much debt? How did it come to be?
Well, thank you so much for that question. I agree that that has been the dominant narrative around Puerto Rico's debt. And there are a lot of root causes to Puerto Rico's debt. But one overarching part of this narrative is the fact that Puerto Rico has been a colony of the United States since 1898, and it hasn't had the opportunity really to develop its own economic future or economic plan without the United States in position. So there were a few things to point to that contributed to the debt. One is that the economy of Puerto Rico, the nature of colonial relationships is that they're beneficial to the country that holds the colony, right? So Puerto Rico's economy was very much structured for a few decades around tax incentives for multinational corporations to set up shop there. And those tax incentives started to be phased out in 1996, and they were phased out in 2006 completely. But the effects of that just go to a more fundamental issue. It's not just like, oh, we should just like bring back those incentives. It really goes back to a fundamental issue of the Puerto Rican economy being run by outside interests. And another example is the Jones Act, whereby consumer goods in Puerto Rico are way more expensive than they need to be because there's a law in the United States that requires everything that comes into Puerto Rico to come from U.S. flagships. Another issue I'd like to highlight is the fact that it had become clear that Puerto Rico was in a position where it couldn't pay back its debt before this big announcement in 2015 by the then governor, and there were predatory financial interests that took advantage of that. So there were financial actors, including some big banks and big hedge funds, that were involved in a debt issuance in 2014. Its terms were very bad, and other debt issuances in the past were also terms that were not beneficial. It's a complex issue. Obviously, there are a lot of different actors at play, but it definitely complicates the narrative of, oh, it's just Puerto Rico borrowing too much money that it can pay.
The New York Times piece that I was citing gives a single paragraph amidst this kind of celebratory coverage that says, you know, sort of, oh, by the by, critics have also demanded an audit of how the large debt was incurred and demanded that those responsible face prosecution or other accountability. That was one paragraph out of a 28-paragraph story by my count. But an audit, a question of how this debt was accrued, would seem to be like the first thing that you would need to do before you start celebrating the reduction of it.
Yes, and that actually has been a public demand by Puerto Ricans for many years. And it also highlights a fatal flaw in the PROMESA law. So just to give a little bit of background, PROMESA was a federal law passed in 2016, and it created tools to restructure Puerto Rico's debt, but it came at the cost of an unelected and unaccountable fiscal control board. So this is a 7-member entity. Its members are appointed by the president. Most of them come from lists from Democratic and Republican leaders of Congress. So this is a 7-member board that, you know, Puerto Ricans have no say over. And the members of the board are just not accountable to Puerto Ricans. And this law gave them a lot of power over Puerto Rico. So there are two main things that they're empowered to do. So they represent, they're supposed to represent the interests of Puerto Rico in the bankruptcy proceedings in court. And they also have final say over fiscal plans and budgets, which means that they can block the implementation of laws that the Puerto Rico legislature passes. It means that they can impose austerity measures to build up the money, right, to pay bondholders. So they have a lot of power. And meanwhile, you have the people of Puerto Rico who have been calling for an audit of the debt. So the fact that the board proceeded with this debt restructuring without having a comprehensive audit of the debt is an example of how it's not responsive to Puerto Ricans. But further down the line, under immense pressure, they actually filed papers in court to saying that billions and billions of dollars of the debt was actually issued illegally. And they also started some lawsuits against some of the financial actors involved in the issuance of some of the debt. But they didn't fully pursue those claims. And now with this restructuring deal, those claims go nowhere. And this deal that was just announced, that the judge confirmed the 18th of January, it actually leaves Puerto Ricans paying billions of dollars to bondholders of this debt that hasn't been audited, that was legally challenged in court, but there was no resolution to that issue. And instead, the board kept negotiating and negotiating with bondholders until they're actually, getting a good deal back. And one thing to note also is that there were a lot of predatory actors involved within the bankruptcy who, once Puerto Rico had already said, we can't pay back this debt, some entities, even after Hurricane Maria, decided to buy some of these bonds because they were such low prices.
Right.
So some of these hedge funds that are termed vulture funds because of their predatory practices, they negotiated with the board and negotiated with the board to get a good deal. So when we talk about the debt being cut, some of those cuts aren't real cuts to some of the bondholders who bought them at a steep discount. But the issue of auditing the debt, it's just one instance that you see that the board was not being responsive to public demand, right? Even though they were supposed to be representing Puerto Rico in the bankruptcy proceeding.
And when we say the board, we're talking about the Federal Oversight and Management Board, which many people call La Junta. And as almost a detour, some of the members actually of that board have links to the entities that were involved in creating the debt in the first place. There's lots of reasons to question whether or not this board is truly responsive to Puerto Ricans.
That's right. That's right. There have been a lot of conflict of interest identified for some of the board members and some of the former board members and some of their highly paid consultants. So I think we Puerto Ricans and others are right to be skeptical of where alliances truly lie.
Well, so Natalie Horesco, executive director of the board, told the New York Times in this piece, quote, "This period of financial crisis is coming to an end," close quote. And I just wonder how you hear such a declarative statement in terms of what's really going to happen as a result of this deal. I mean, the crisis that has driven, the ongoing crisis that has driven, for example, so many people to leave Puerto Rico over the last decade or so, is that ending?
Yes, I would have to disagree with her statement. One figure that the board has touted is they came out and they said 80% of the debt is being cut. And I've seen that in all of the mainstream coverage in the U.S. of the debt restructuring deal. But that figure is actually highly misleading. And the judge herself, in her confirmation order, said that the debt of the central government was actually just being reduced to 31%. And that is not actually being felt equitably across the board, right? So there are some bondholders who are receiving less cuts and some people who are owed money that are getting away a much higher cut. And those include small local businesses who have lent their services, their labor to the central government, who says being cut more. But when they say 80%, they're not counting this $7 billion in upfront cash some bondholders are getting, and a up to $3.5 billion that some bondholders could get depending on if the revenues of the sales tax exceed expectations. And the sales tax in Puerto Rico is 11.5%, which is way higher than anywhere else in the United States. And sales tax is widely understood as a regressive form of taxation because it's felt different across the income and wealth spectrum, right? If you have less money, you feel an 11.5% tax a lot more. So that's a big myth. I wanted to debunk this figure of 80% that doesn't take into consideration all these billions of dollars that bondholders are receiving. And then, you know, a big constituency of this deal that was just confirmed are retirees, pension holders. So I have to say that we did have a big win in Puerto Rico by pension holders who organized, and now people who retired from public service for the central government of Puerto Rico are not going to see a proposed 8.5% monthly cut that the board was trying to impose on pension holders making over a certain amount per month, over $1,500 a month in pensions. So eliminating that cut was a huge victory. And again, it goes to show that the board, when it is responsive, it's only responsive under immense pressure. You know, they kept saying, oh, no, we can't possibly eliminate this cut. If we eliminate this cut, the judge can't confirm this plan. Like, you know, like you said earlier, like the pay needs to be shared. You know, everybody needs to take the cut, which, you know, is also misleading because pensioners had already seen cuts pre-PROMESA, even when the government had decreased their benefits in part to pay bondholders that they were prioritizing over the their pension obligations. So that's a huge win. However, the current employees of the government are still going to see drastic cuts really to their retirement at the end of the day because cost of living adjustments are frozen and have been frozen since 2007-2008, and because they're changing from a defined benefit, meaning like, you know, like if I worked X number of years, I'm going to get, you know, X amount per month. So they're freezing those defined benefit plans and changing them to defined contribution plans, which means really it falls onto the employees' own money that they earn taken out of their paycheck, really, to fund their retirement. So at the end of the day, like when current employees retire, like their benefits are going to decrease a significant amount. So wanted to highlight that as well, while also, you know, often we don't celebrate our wins enough. And, it, you know, it is a huge deal that current retirees are no longer facing this 8.5% cut on their monthly pension benefits.
Absolutely. I think it's very important to acknowledge the impact of activism. And in this case, and even here, though, the language cues say so much. The New York Times piece cited that they said activists and elected officials did notch a big victory, which I love, activists and elected officials pitted against whom exactly, you know, but what I honed in on this is in the piece they say, you know, they did manage to get the board to back away from these plans to cut pensions for retired teachers and other government workers. And it says, quote, many Puerto Ricans feared that such cuts would exacerbate poverty among older people, close quote. And I'm like, you think, you know, like that's a fear. That's a fear that people had, you know, that cuts to pensions might exacerbate poverty. And yet in the same story, statements like that of David Skeel, the chairman of the FOMB, who says flat out, it's not going to lead to more cuts. Those kinds of statements are just out there, declarative. It's not like Skeel hopes or imagines that this deal won't lead to cuts. He's just saying it won't lead to cuts. But meanwhile, the reason for fighting the pension cuts was that people had this fear, this emotional feeling that it might lead to poverty. You know, I mean, the language just makes me a little nutsy.
Yeah, it's very detached. And again, it just shows how far removed they are from the real lives of real Puerto Ricans and what the real state of affairs is on the island.
And I would ask you about that because there's so much energy and so many people that are missing from elite media's narrative. And, you know, we complain about that narrative for many reasons, what it gets wrong, but it's also who it leaves out. And it would leave you more depressed than perhaps you might need to be, because there is a lot of pushback. There is a lot of activism, and there are certainly plenty of people who have an idea of a different way forward than this plan talks about.
Definitely, definitely. And you know, we've been talking about bondholders and retirees, but also at the end of the day, we're talking about the central pot of money that the central government uses for all sorts of things that impact all Puerto Ricans in terms of the public services available and also investments in public institutions. Since the board has come in, a lot of public schools have closed. The budget for the University of Puerto Rico has been slashed. And there have been a lot of hikes for energy use. So we've been talking about people who the central government owes money to. But at the end of the day, this is an issue that touches on everyone living on the island and reverberates beyond that with people in the diaspora living all over the states and beyond.
Well, let me ask you finally, you know, the naturalness with which elite media talk about unelected overseers, not even all of them living in Puerto Rico, some with important conflicts of interest, negotiating with bondholders who've been incentivized for years toward exploitation. That's presented as kind of the grown-ups talking, you know, and of course they should decide the future. And it's very unnerving, you know, but as you've said, there's a tremendous amount of energy that's fighting that narrative. And I wonder, would these issues be addressed, or to what extent do you think they would be addressed by the Self-Determination Act? And if you could tell us a little bit about that and the impact that that might have.
Sure. So the Puerto Rico Self-Determination Act is a piece of federal legislation that has been introduced both in the House and the Senate that basically would create a way for Puerto Rico to chart its preferred political path forward. It would create delegates who are elected by Puerto Ricans to negotiate with a commission in the United States about, like, okay, what are the different options and what are different transition plans, importantly, like, to get to all those different options so you can have an option for complete independence without any formal political connection to the United States. You can have what's called the free association, which basically means Puerto Rico would be independent, but it would have a bilateral treaty where you can have different arrangements and a closer connection to the United States or statehood. And out of the conversation is often left out. It's like, okay, people sort of envision from one day to the next arriving at a new political future, but really talking about what a transition would look like, what it would look like at the end of the day, and then it would leave the final decision to a final vote in Puerto Rico based on those different options that have been pre-negotiated. So I think for a long time, since the early 50s, there's been this idea that it's like, oh, okay, now Puerto Rico is not a colony anymore. Now we're this commonwealth. We're done with that. But I think both the Fiscal Control Board and I think also the federal response to Maria has really shifted the narrative around Puerto Rico and the understanding that at the end of the day, it is a colony of the United States. You know, how else would you describe the United States being able to pass a law that imposes an unelected, unaccountable 7-member entity that can block laws passed by the local legislature, that can negotiate on its behalf but not be accountable to in the bankruptcy proceeding that's going to affect the future of Puerto Rico for the next decade? So I think, like, the veil has been lifted in the last few years, and I think there's good momentum to pave a better future, and one that actually has Puerto Ricans on the driver's seat.
Obviously, what we interpret as forward movement has to do with a vision, and it's often unspoken or not spelled out. And it's clear that for some people, the picture of Puerto Rico, the vision, is a place where U.S. citizens can go and play and maybe buy a business at a cut rate, you know, like that's the goal. Some people have said, you know, Puerto Rico without Puerto Ricans is what some people want. And so for U.S. listeners who or readers who don't really understand, that can be presented as the positive way forward. We only hear those voices of Puerto Ricans who want to stay there, you know, who want to stay there and live and thrive and want their children to stay and live and thrive. They're kind of sprinkled in as like human interest quotes or color. But those people have a vision, too, for the future of Puerto Rico. And elite media are not as interested in that. If we heard in a regular way from Puerto Ricans who live in Puerto Rico, who want to live there and thrive there, what would they be adding to news media, and what would you like to see journalists do differently?
I have to say, this issue of displacement, it has been happening for a while. Puerto Rico has lost a huge percentage of its population in the last 15 years. And meanwhile, as you mentioned, you know, there are some wealthy investors who are coming to Puerto Rico to take advantage of some tax incentives to, live in a beautiful island. And there's been an effect of displacement. And there are a lot of Puerto Ricans on the island who are living and creating their own vision of Puerto Rico, right? Like, there's a resurgence in a local agriculture movement. There used to be a lot of agriculture in Puerto Rico since industrialization that has been largely phased out. Now there's a resurgence of let's grow our stuff locally. Like, we have, all of this land that we can grow things on year round, instead of, importing all of these expensive produce from the United States. There's movement to have, more sources of solar energy. After Maria happened, their electricity was out for a very long time for a lot of the island. And there was, this bright Casa Pueblo, this entity did have energy because they were solar powered. And, they were a huge hub in the community who were actually a source of support. And there were all sorts of mutual aid movements that came up, especially after Hurricane Maria. So there is a lot of activism and vision and just creation happening at the very local grassroots level. So there's definitely, hope that moving forward, that vision and that creation will prevail.
We've been speaking with Natalia Renta, senior policy strategist at the Center for Popular Democracy. They're online at populardemocracy.org. Natalia Renta, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
when it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for kids, teens, or young adults. It's just not.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals and volatile organic compounds into your body.
And nicotine, the same highly addictive substance found in regular cigarettes.
Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
Affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control. And priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Well, if you look at your watch, you'll notice this is the time of the day each week that I, the Mockster, do a thing called The Mock. Yeah, I take a word, an artist, a performer, and I play some cover songs, tribute songs, songs about said theme. I've mentioned my alliteration mock for tonight is Moon Martin. There is a Moon Martin mock coming up in a few seconds. But before I get to the mock, I do want to remind you that Attic Records joins you in supporting WRCT. Attic Records is located in Millvale, and they're open 7 days a week. They provide new and used records and CDs from metal to reggae, hip-hop to doo-wop, and all stops in between. They're family-owned and operated. Attic Records pays for quality used records and CDs with no collection too big, no collection too small. You can visit Attic Records in Millvale or call them up at 412-821-8484. We're going to turn into this Moon Martin mock. Now it is 2021, but if you've heard me in the past few weeks, I've been doing what I've been calling a Flashback Friday or a Turnback Tuesday. It depends on which day you're listening. And I'm doing that. I've been doing it all night long. Some of my sets have been new and original. Other sets, I kind of just pulled out the music and, I made it sound like it was new. I'm telling you that secret now because for my mock, I'm doing this Moon Martin mock, which I originally did back in August 20th of 2010. So this mock is 11 years old. And I might throw a second mock in to kind of fill the hour up because, you know, this is just how life is in August for me, the mockster. But I think we need to kick off the mock with Moon Martin's most famously penned song. It was made a hit by somebody else. So let's start the mock with of the Moon Martin penned Bad Case of Loving You, originally put out in 1978 by Moon Martin. Robert did it in 79.